there's been a lot of talk recently about whether our country is ready for women leaders. Now, that really takes me back, but I know many of you and can attest as to how smart, determined, effective, and dare I say, likable you all are.
Hillary Clinton has a right to be bitter. This is, after all, a question that's irked her for at least two decades now. And if you really want to hear what a woman tired of all this shit sounds like, you can listen to her back in 2008 in a primary against Barack Obama.
What can you say to the voters of New Hampshire on this stage tonight who see your resume and like it, but are hesitating on the likability issue where they seem to like Barack Obama more?
Well, that hurts my feelings.
I'm sorry, Senator. I'm sorry.
This same question dogged her again in the 2016 election, even though her opponent, let's be honest, is not exactly the world's most friendly and lovable fellow. It's already being asked now of 2020 Democratic hopefuls Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris. And here at home, depending on where in Canada you live, you may remember hearing it wondered about Kathleen Wynne, Rachel Notley, Christy Clark, and others. Some of them have even apologized for it.
Sorry. Not sorry. I'm really genuinely sorry that more people don't like me.
These women might be accomplished and powerful, intelligent and articulate, empathetic and understanding and well-versed in policy, but they just don't seem nice enough. And they know you think about them this way. So how long have women seeking the highest level of political office had to try to walk this tightrope? Is it even possible to be tough enough and likable enough and woman enough at the same time? What are we really demanding of these women when we wonder about their likability? There are not very many people in the world who can answer this from firsthand experience. And in fact, in this country, there is only one. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story.
Women have to pay their dues in ways that men don't. Men are assumed to be able to lead, whether they can or not. Women must prove that they are able to lead.
The Right Honorable Kim Campbell is Canada's 19th Prime Minister, and still, 26 years later, its only female Prime Minister. What are we actually talking about when we talk about whether or not a female politician is likable?
I think when we're talking about whether a female politician is likable, we're talking about whether she is relatable, somebody sees her as a person, and whether that particular woman strikes the balance between commanding respect for her gravitas or ability and not being too threatening, communicating also some warmth. I think it's a kind of an alchemy, a chemistry of it's not just about being friendly. I think it's also being able to have that warmth while at the same time having the sense of strength. Because I think just to be friendly, you might not even get to that stage of the conversation.
And why do you think when we talk about it, it's always in the context of a female candidate who is questioned to lack it?
Well, I think it's one of the ways of attacking. If you grow up in a world where women are not leaders, or anybody who is not the prototypical leader comes along, you know, like Barack Obama. I mean, for people, for racist people in the United States, their worst nightmare was to have a black man in the White House. And so what is one of the ways that you attack him? Not lack of likability, but he's not legitimate. He wasn't born there. That whole birther thing was a way of giving people an excuse to vent their discomfort that somebody who looked and sounded like Barack Obama was in the White House. And the same way, there are these code words that people use to attack people they don't think belong there. You know, if you don't think somebody who looks or sounds like a woman belongs there, then you will find reasons to dismiss that person. And it's interesting because Margaret Thatcher, I'm not sure anybody would have described her as likable in any traditional way.
Right.
But, you know, the British have this cultural thing, as some people say, that, you know, men who are, you know, used to being spanked by their nannies when they're young. And Margaret Thatcher was sort of the nanny for some of the people in her party. You know, that she was very tough. But she also was not somebody who was trying to open the door to other women. she was very attractive. I mean, Margaret Thatcher was a beautiful woman. And she had all of that you couldn't dismiss her, you know, as not being attractive. But she was that archetype of the woman who, you know, is the only man in the cabinet kind of thing. So sometimes women are respected if they are seen as being, you know, stronger than anybody else.
Right.
It's an archetype. It depends on where you are. It depends on the political culture of the society. It depends upon where people are historically, what they've been used to. And every woman who serves, I mean, I remember, you know, many women I knew who didn't like Margaret Thatcher because they said she didn't open doors for other women. She was really a queen bee, et cetera. And I said, you know, whatever you think, she did open doors for women. Because after Margaret Thatcher, you couldn't say a woman could never be tough enough to be a prime minister.
Yeah.
Because you just say, well, what about Margaret Thatcher? And in the summer of 93, when I was, you know, traveling across the country, even before the election campaign, little old men would run up to me and they'd say, oh, you're going to be our Maggie Thatcher. I was a woman, and they loved the idea. We were going to have our own Margaret Thatcher. We were going to have a woman leader, and that's how they saw me. So every time a woman takes on a role that has not been held by women before, she may be a human sacrifice. In other words, it may be hard to hang on. But you gradually redefine who gets to do that job. And you change people's sense of what is natural in that job.
There's no shortage of unlikable male politicians, but we don't talk about whether or not they're likable.
Well, I think the idea is that men are the default category. Their entitlement to be there is unquestioned. So women have to, you know, leap over certain hurdles. They have to be feminine. They can't in any way be they have to, you know, do as Ginger Rogers did, everything backwards in high heels, not losing their femininity,
right,
as they are performing remarkable feats. And this notion of likability is a terrible kind of catch-22, because again, what is used against women who seek power and who take positions of power and authority is that supposedly they have lost something, you know. And people say, well, you know, if women come into power, well, they lose their lovely feminine nature. And that's really, I think, what likability is a code for, that they somehow have lost some aspect of feminine softness.
And of course, if they keep that softness as they run for office, then there are questions about whether they're tough enough, right?
Yeah, then they're weak, then they're not strong. You know, it's interesting because, you know, I look back and I look at myself, pictures of myself when I was prime minister, and, you know, I think, I mean, I look so young, and you know, I'm sure there were a lot of aspects of my image, et cetera, that led people to wonder about me. I'd had the advantage of serving in government in some difficult cabinet portfolios. But even then, sometimes the things that I accomplished were not attributed to me. It was assumed that, you know, I remember when my gun control legislation passed and people couldn't get over that this really remarkably big and comprehensive piece of legislation had gone through the Commons. And I remember somebody saying, oh, well, Mulroney must have pulled her irons out of the fire. You know, well, Brian Mulroney was, you know, great to work for, but one of the reasons he was great to work for is that he left you alone to do your thing, and he didn't pull anybody's irons out of the fire. But it was like, you know, they couldn't believe that somebody like me could have accomplished that legislatively. So, you know, you really are in a kind of catch-22, that if you are seen to be too feminine, then people assume either that you're not able or that you are not responsible for what you've accomplished. And then if you're tough, then people assume you've sacrificed an essential part of your nature in order to be out there as, what do they call it? You call women, you know, ball busters or whatever the expression is.
Right. Do you remember walking that tightrope consciously, like trying to be tough enough but not too tough in things that you would say?
You know, it's interesting that when you asked me that, when I look back, I don't remember it as a conscious thing. I think because I'd been in public life for a long time and I had developed a style of speaking. And people who liked me for what I was, that I was direct, I was straightforward. So I don't honestly remember, I may well have, but I don't remember thinking, oh, I must do this or I must do that. Certainly, there were some things. For example, young women are often very surprised when I tell them that I never wore trousers when I was prime minister or minister, except for, you know, if I went to a sporting event or something. I always wore suits with pantyhose and, you know, usually heels of some kind, not right. really high ones. That was just what we wore. And I always say that I, you know, I'm very grateful to Hillary Clinton, who I think as First Lady kind of normalized the pantsuit as appropriate professional attire for a woman. I say Laura Bush wore pantsuits all the time, too.
Hillary but, made it iconic for female politicians,
yeah,
really.
She did. And, of course, Angela Merkel. You know, it must have a closet with an infinite number of blazers of different colors and, you know, and usually dark pants. And that's her uniform. It's something that now nobody thinks about. But in those days, I guess part of subscribing to the need to be feminine was that I did wear skirts and dressed in that way in all of my professional undertakings.
Well, it's interesting that you say that it's only being noticed now. Because I really feel like that applies to a lot of the conversation we're having, that you didn't necessarily hear the term likability when you were running for office. But it's over the last 5 to 8 years that it's really become something that we're cognizant of people discussing. Yeah. I remember certainly the first time I heard it was when, or at least I can remember hearing it, was when Barack Obama said it about Hillary in one of the debates. I don't know if you remember, but
well,
he said, you're likable enough, Hillary.
Her. Yeah. Yeah. Well, when people were talking about it, she wasn't likable enough, and he said, you were likable enough. And it came actually off in a rather condescending way. I'm not sure that's how he meant it. But, you know, I think he was sort of basically saying, you know, this is not an issue. But I will go back, going back to my time in office, when I was justice minister, I remember speaking to a group of women in Ottawa, because in those days people did come together, and this question of women in politics and women in leadership was very interesting, and there were a lot of women and women journalists and politicians there. And I remember somebody had written about me, because this was as people were beginning to think that maybe Brian Mulroney was going to step down. It was before he announced he would, but there was a lot of scuttlebutt about, you know, who might replace him. And somebody had written and described me as crushingly ambitious. And I remember saying at the speech, you know, whom have I crushed? I'm not aware of having tried to crush or overpower anyone. And even in terms of being ambitious, you know, that's another word that has become a catch-22 for women. When I was a little girl, people used to say, what's your ambitious? What's your ambition? What do you want to be when you grow up? And to say, well, my ambition is to be such and such, every little kid had an ambition, you know, to be a fireman. I wanted to be the first woman Secretary General of the UN. I mean, we all had these goals. And ambition for a woman wasn't a bad word. And then it became a bad word. And, you know, maybe even to contemplate the possibility of running to be leader was considered unacceptable. But I remember this notion that I was, and it was a female reporter described me as being crushingly ambitious. And I thought, you know, I have never tried to undermine any of my colleagues, male or female. I mean, whom have I crushed? It's frustrating that if you're successful, then people assume that you must have been crushing, or there must be something unsavory about how you got there. And it's just ridiculous. And I think one of the reasons women are successful in politics is precisely because that's not how they operate.
Right.
You know, somebody like Angela Merkel is very strong, but she's not heavy-handed. And even when, you know, when Vladimir Putin, you know, tried to intimidate her by bringing the dog into the room when they were having a public aftermath of a meeting, and
she
did this, and she said after to people, well, you know, he has to do that. It's a man thing for him. And, you know, the way she sort of kind of dismissed it, I thought, you know, you go, girl. I mean, she was, you know, she got it that you know, he was trying to intimidate her, and she didn't rise to the bait, and she didn't, but she understood what she was dealing with. I think all of women who've been involved in politics have faced sexism and pushback, and sometimes the pushback, you're not sure whether it's sexist, you're not sure whether somebody is just uncomfortable that somebody who looks and sounds like you is being that forceful about an issue. And most of us try not to pay too much attention to it, because what is the alternative? Is the alternative to run away and hide?
Yeah.
To not do your job?
Well, you talk about Angela Merkel and how she faces down Vladimir Putin, which leads me to ask you how you felt watching Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump. Because again, speaking of somebody who's been labeled ambitious, right?
Well, you know, I watched that campaign, and, you know, in my view, she won the election. I think that it's becoming very clear that it was stolen from her. you know, whether it was done by suppressing her vote using those online things, in which case, you know, that's hard to know, or whether there were some other hanky-panky. But the fact of the matter is 65 million Americans put their X or pulled the lever for a woman as president, 3 million more than voted for Donald Trump. And yet it was interesting, after the election, everybody was talking about, oh, what a flawed candidate she was.
Yeah.
She got more votes than any presidential candidate in history who wasn't named Obama.
But she was labeled as so ambitious, like she'd been seeking this since she was the first lady, and et cetera, et cetera. That was a real narrative.
Yeah, and she built a career so that she could be credible doing it. And I thought she was remarkable, and I watched her during that campaign, and she never lost her cool.
Yeah.
And she kept to the point. But, you know, she wasn't, I think she was fine against Donald Trump, and in fact, she got 3 million more votes than he did. There were obviously a lot of people who were persuaded by her, notwithstanding the vast amount of what we now know was incredible negative online advertising about her. You know, all the hate stuff that was coming out of the, you know, the Russian bots and stuff. I mean, now we know what it was. And, you know, Hillary wants to bring in Sharia law and Hillary, all this stuff. And that was designed to keep people from voting for her, or to suppress her vote, or to make people decide not to vote at all.
And a lot of that stuff picked on her ambition and her likability.
Yeah. But what I think is interesting is that Donald Trump didn't have that same kind of online attack. The Russians weren't going after him. They weren't using social media to go after him. They were using it to go after Hillary Clinton. And notwithstanding that, she still got more votes than he did. She still got, 65 million votes as the first woman to run for president. And so when people say, well, you know, she was a flawed candidate, I go, wait a minute, compared to who? No, she was in a race that wasn't fair. I think she was remarkable through the whole campaign. And even, I mean, the whole thing about her health, this was also somebody that was totally made up. And this is about that this Roger Stone started this thing. But I watched her and I couldn't get over how she always looked fresh. She always looked energetic. She really had this incredible stamina. But I think so much of how people evaluate the candidates in those circumstances depends on the preconceptions they bring to it. And my own experience was that the people who were hardest on me were members of the Ottawa Press Gallery, who covered national politics all the time. And one of them sort of curled his lip and said to me one day, you know, I've known every prime minister since Lester Pearson. And the implication was that you don't look or sound like any of them. And I didn't. So if you have this view of what a prime minister should look or sound like, you know, I'm not going to fulfill that. And so you would probably prefer to walk over hot coals than acknowledge that perhaps you had gender bias in your view of who should be prime minister. So you will look for ways of validating your discomfort, which means that the non-prototypical person never gets the benefit of the doubt. Anything you do that's a mistake gets, you know, it's like Hillary's emails. You know, it gets raised so out of proportion. And in the case of the American campaign, Donald Trump did so many things that in any other campaign would have disqualified the candidate. You know, the Access Hollywood tapes, how did he survive that?
Yeah.
And how could Hillary's emails have come anywhere close to the Access Hollywood tape, his kowtowing to Putin? I mean, all of this stuff. And she set out the case, and now when you look back and you see people, you know, retweet the videos of her speeches as she's setting it all out, you know, she was right.
When you were prime minister 26 years ago, did you think then that you'd shattered the ceiling and that there would soon be many other female prime ministers?
Well, I didn't know, and I knew it was kind of a poison chalice in a sense that, you know, I had so much support from caucus, I couldn't really not run for leader. You know, I couldn't really say, well, I don't think we can win. I also think that when you commit to something, you hope in your heart that, you know, your hope of hopes that you will win, mainly because it just was so hard to believe that people would vote for parties that could not form a government. That didn't seem to make sense, but they did. But I didn't really know. I know at the time, while I was prime minister, it was clear that it meant a lot to people. And when we lost, I worried how that would be perceived. And I don't think I'm just comforting myself, but what I have found, particularly in the last few years when I came back to Canada and went to Alberta to create the Peter Lougheed Leadership College and was spending more time in the country, was how many people said to me, you know, I was in grade 8 when you were prime minister, or I remember I was in university, and I remember how much it meant to me. And they don't say, and then, you know, my world came to an end when you lost. That obviously for a lot of people, but particularly for women, my having become prime minister changed their sense of what was possible. And I remember one of my supporters, a man, you know, with tears streaming down his face, saying the night that I won the convention, you know, this is for my daughter. I mean, the one good thing about, for example, what Prime Minister Trudeau is doing and providing so many opportunities for women to serve in his cabinet is he's creating sort of a farm team of women who have credibility and visibility to make them believable and quite plausible leaders for a governing party. But that's, you know, it's taken some time. And even when I was in government, I mean, Brian Mulroney made me Minister of Justice. I was the first woman to be Minister of Justice in Canadian history, the first woman to be Defense Minister. And these were things that helped to give me some credibility and stature. So, you know, these are the things that you have to have in place, because women have to pay their dues in ways that men don't. Men are assumed to be able to lead, whether they can or not. Women must prove that they are able to lead. And so it helps if male leaders give them opportunities to do that.
Who do you look at now in Canadian politics and say, that woman there can be prime minister someday?
Well, you know, I think, you know, Chrystia Freeland, Jody Wilson-Raybo, although, you know, her recent shift is interesting, but I don't think it's a reflection on her, and a number of other women in the Liberal caucus, but those two in particular have carried heavy-duty portfolios and done well. I mean, the justice portfolio, the right-to-die legislation, the legalization of cannabis, and then the things that Chrystia Freeland has dealt with. I mean, these are really important issues where they've been able to shine. In the Conservative Party, I was sorry that Rona Ambrose stepped out. I don't know whether she'll ever return to politics. I think she may. I feel that she's been there, done that. But I think her, as interim leader, she was very credible. And if I may say, likable. You know, she, you know, her way of handling herself in the House of Commons. Because being leader of the opposition is actually a catch-22 for a woman. Because, you know, in the summer of 93, Gallup said that I had the highest approval rating for a prime minister in 30 years. And which was, when you think about it, quite extraordinary, because that included the period that Pierre Trudeau was prime minister. But I was governing, and, you know, I'd gone to the G7 summit, my redefining of the ministries and the government, all of those things made me very popular. But when you get into campaign mode, then you have to be more adversarial. And that's a harder thing for women to do. And that's where the not being feminine enough, or that's where the shrill, that's where all these things the people want to lob at you come in. And that's why I think to be leader of the opposition and leading the opposition in question period is a tough role for a woman, because by definition, this is adversarial. You're on the attack. And I think Rona Ambrose did that extremely well.
What can Canadians who are listening to this and agree that there's a double standard out there actually do right now to start combating it?
Well, there's several things. One of them is we have to be aware of our own implicit attitudes. We may intellectually feel women should have all these opportunities, but that doesn't mean that we don't viscerally react negatively when we see a woman doing something that we're not used to seeing a woman do. And we have to, you know, stop ourselves and say, you know, am I reacting this way because I'm just not comfortable? This is a new incumbent in this position, or this is a new idea for this person. And you have to be conscious about those attitudes that are unconscious and that may lead you reflexively to dismiss people. You know, the way we think isn't how we think. And in the leadership college that I created at the University of Alberta, one of the things we taught our students was this vast body of knowledge in social and cognitive psychology that helps us to understand the barriers to making good decisions, our cognitive biases, the implicit attitudes, the things that lead us to do things that are either not very good or effective, but that also maybe not be fair. And when we understand that, then we can be more conscious in trying to catch ourselves from making judgments that aren't really based on meritocracy, that are based on our sense of, you know, we're not used to this. And gradually then we build up our own ability to support non-prototypical candidates and women in particular. But I think what's interesting is that there's been so much research recently on how people think and, you know, the views that people have. For example, that idiot at Google who wrote the memo about women not being cut out for tech, and happily he was fired. But what was so appalling about that memo was how uninformed it was, because, in fact, many of the founding thinkers of modern information technology were women. Now, you don't know about them, because when people don't think you belong, you get left out of the history. And more now, people are starting to recover these women and others who've been left out to show what roles they play. Some of the foundational thinkers in mathematics. But really, I mean, the women in the space programming. And not only women, but women of color who were doubly excluded. So, you know, the New York Times has created a new feature in their obituary column as of the last few years called Overlooked No More. And they started by saying, since they started doing obituaries about 1850, most of the people whose lives they wrote about were white men. They realized that they had left out all sorts of A, women, B, people of color, who had made huge contributions. And so they are going back now. And if you look at the New York Times, the obituary column, almost every day there is an article about somebody extraordinary who never got recognized when they died. Some of these people, it's amazing. And you think, I never knew about that person. I never knew there was that person who was such a pioneer in science or in business or in astronomy. I mean, and of course, when you don't know about them, then you don't think that people like that belong. You think that if somebody comes along and wants to do this, some woman, well, she has to prove that she's better than everybody else because women can't do it. And it's rubbish. So we need to start understanding that women do extraordinary things. When we, you know, if we want to have a more inclusive future, we have to have a more inclusive history. We have to go back and start recognizing the people who have, in fact, made a difference. And it's not just women; it's also, you know, people of color and other ethnicities that have been left out. And it's shocking. And we are the losers for it, because we are given a distorted view of our own history and a distorted view of who has contributed to the things we live with today, whether it's, you know, advances in governance or science or medicine or social development. You know, we need to rediscover those contributors so that we can recognize people like them as viable leaders for the future.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell. That was wonderful.
Nice to talk to you.
The Right Honorable Kim Campbell, Canada's 19th Prime Minister and still only female Prime Minister. That was The Big Story. For more from us, obviously subscribe wherever you're listening to us, but visit our website, thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can find all sorts of other episodes there. You can also toss us a line, tell us who we should talk to next, and find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN or our whole family at Frequency Pods. We are on Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get podcasts. We'd love a review if you like this one. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.